Hidden Plans for the Opera Garnier. Élodie quickened her pace. It was 8:50 a.m. She scurried as fast as she could up l'Avenue de l'Opera. Due to the time of day, she had to weave in and out of the throngs of suit-clad office workers on their way to the posh offices which populated the elegant avenue and its side streets. Unlike most of the other wide boulevards that were laid out in Paris in the mid-19th century, there were no trees lining l'Avenue de l'Opera. Branches and leaves would have blocked the view of the building that had instigated the creation of the street itself. A whole section of old Paris had to be torn down in order to build a straight street between the royal residence of the Louvre and the crown jewel of this new Paris, the Opera Garnier. Even though she'd seen it countless times, as she neared the majestic building, Élodie couldn't help but marvel at its extravagant facade. Before her were the busts of great composers, clusters of gleeful dancers, dedications to the various arts, and gilded allegorical figures. If a person carefully examined all the decoration on the front of the opera house, just above the central row of columns, they could spot the repeating initials N and E. These letters were a nod to the commissioners of the opulent Académie Nationale de Musique, the National Academy of Music, Emperor Napoleon III and Empress Eugénie. It may have been commissioned by the imperial couple. Nevertheless, the grandiose building ended up being named in honor of its architect, Charles Garnier. Famous the world over, Le Palais Garnier was not Paris's first opera house. Founded in 1669 by Louis XIV, the Paris Opera has been housed in various buildings over the course of its 350-year history. In fact, it was an incident at the previous opera house which sparked the building of this new one. Built in 1821, the Palais Garnier's predecessor was located a short distance away on Rue Le Pelletier. On January 14, 1858, the Emperor and Empress were on their way there when Italian anarchist Felice Orsini tried to bomb their carriage. Although the Bonapartes were unscathed, thanks to their iron-lined carriage, the strength of the blast left 156 people injured, 8 fatally, and blew out the glass of neighboring buildings. A new opera house was deemed in public interest and necessary for the safety of the head of state. Considering this event, it isn't surprising that a very special entrance was built for the Emperor and Empress, which Élodie was now in front of. Found on the west side of the Opera Garnier and emblazoned with the Napoleonic eagle, it had a curved ramp designed so the Emperor's carriage could travel up it and straight into an enclosed entrance. This meant he could safely attend the opera without ever having to set foot out in the open. Clever as it was, the Emperor never got to use his ultra-safe entrance. The building was completed in 1875, 5 years after the disastrous Franco-Prussian War, which led to Napoleon III's downfall. Élodie's destination just happened to be right above the Emperor's designated entrance. She flashed a card at the security guard as she darted inside. Most visitors fall to whispers as they enter the opera house. As much as the facade was utterly stunning, the opera's grand staircase was so sumptuous it literally took your breath away. Despite being in a hurry, Elodie lingered for a quick minute to take in its mesmerizing grandeur. This was the first time she could access the building since the lockdown. Absence made her appreciate its intricate details that much more. She walked up the regal staircase slowly as she admired its architectural accents. She took in the ornate columns and balconies, as well as the use of gold ornamentation and candelabras, all perfect examples of the excesses used in the palace's overall design. These features also spoke volumes about the expectations of the emperor, his desire to be noticed and to be remembered for what he did for Paris and his noble subjects. She gazed up at the meticulously painted ceiling overhead, complete with soaring angels. She could only imagine what it might have been like to glide up this spectacular staircase back in the late 19th century, wearing a magnificent dress, furs, and jewels. She guessed that only the very wealthy or nobility could afford this pleasure. It was a place to be and be seen at the time. For grandiose reasons, some staircases were built to stand out and really attract the elegant eye. They command not only a person to notice the flamboyant architectural details, but also for other patrons to observe the fascinating people ascending or descending them. They are an attention grabber, if you will. Garnier's grand staircase reminded Elodie of another one that became well known, the one built into the Titanic. That was also a grand staircase and was meant to be a design centerpiece of that ill-fated vessel, as ill-fated as Napoleon III's military campaign against the Prussians. It was 9:05 when Elodie pushed open the doors to her final destination, the Opera's Library Museum. It was home to over 600,000 documents, from performance programs to music scores. Since starting her research for her PhD dissertation in architecture, Elodie had gotten to know its impressive collections extremely well. Perhaps too well. In fact, the day before the quarantine was announced, she'd come across a very curious exchange of letters, a chain of correspondence between Charles Garnier and a certain Monsieur Blanc. Since the lockdown prevented Elodie from coming back to the library in person, she searched online to find out just who this Monsieur Blanc was. She felt like she was in an episode of the series Inspector Marcel, which she would watch when she took breaks from her own investigating. As she dug online, she discovered that the cost of the opera house was much greater than anticipated. It actually became the most expensive building constructed in France at that time. Altogether, it cost the modern equivalent of a colossal 313 million euros. One of the main reasons for this towering expense stemmed from the fact that the plot of land chosen for the enormous building was very wet. Despite months spent trying to pump out the water, they eventually had to resort to building a large cistern to hold the water. This is the legendary lake, which was still found beneath its depths. The 25 by 50 meter, 80 by 262 feet, reservoir was off limits to the public, but was used by firemen for training exercises. The building wasn't complete when Napoleon III fell from power, but it was well underway. Since France's coffers had been drained by the costly Franco-Prussian War, and subsequent repatriations to Germany, there were not enough state funds to finish the opera house. So the government borrowed 4.9 million gold francs from François Blanc, a wealthy French financier and real estate promoter. The letters Élodie had come across clearly showed the growing professional relationship between Blanc and Garnier. After completing the Paris Opera, the architect was hired by Blanc to design a concert hall for his casino in Monte Carlo, Monaco. This would later become the official opera house of the Côte d'Azur Principality. One specific letter had caught Élodie's attention. Although it wasn't plainly spelled out, it seemed to make reference to a special request Blanc had made to Garnier, something that would remain just between the two of them, a secret passageway. And Élodie was determined to find it. Her heart was practically beating out of her chest as she strode down an aisle lined with bookcases in the direction of the documents section. "Bonjour, Jean," she greeted the distinguished-looking 40-ish librarian sitting behind a large oak desk. Although he was somewhat reserved, he was still approachable, and they developed a nice professional friendship since she'd started coming to the library. "Bonjour, Élodie. So nice to see you." His face lit up when he lifted his eyes from his copy of Opera magazine and saw who was there. "Jean, let's catch up later over a coffee," Élodie blurted. She knew he'd want to chat. It had been months since they'd last seen each other. However, at this very moment, she couldn't handle any small talk. She was too excited. "But first, I need to see Garnier's floor plans for the opera house, especially the final ones. Any that show close-up detail or potential last-minute modifications, please, Jean."
"Sure thing," Jean replied. "I'll be right back."
5 minutes later, he returned bearing a stack of oversized file folders.
"I know you don't need reminding, but please make sure you don't get any dust or dirt on them," he dutifully added.
He slowly set the precious documents down on one of the large examination tables. "Of course," Élodie said. She knew the drill by now. Setting her purse down on a chair, she removed a small pouch containing a pristine pair of white archival gloves, which she put on gingerly. Despite bubbling over with excitement, she carefully opened the first folder and went about scrutinizing the plans for any clues to the whereabouts of a secret passageway.
"Hungry?"
asked Jean, smiling down at Élodie.
"Huh?"
Élodie was completely lost in the collection of plans.
"It's almost 2, he informed her.
"Oh my," she exclaimed. She'd been so focused on her quest that she hadn't noticed the hours flying by. Jean could tell she was a little hesitant.
"Let's go grab a sandwich, and you can tell me what you're looking for," he suggested. "Maybe I can help."
"Okay, sounds good," she agreed. She figured since she hadn't discovered anything on her own that morning, she could probably use some assistance this afternoon. Élodie removed her white gloves, returned them to their pouch, and scooped up her purse. Then the pair headed towards the exit. In addition to being surrounded by offices, the Opera Garnier was in the heart of Paris's main shopping district. This meant there were a lot of chain eateries in the area. However, Jean knew where there was a hidden local bakery. What's more, it was also a previous winner of the Best Baguette in Paris contest. As they were on the late side of lunch, There was fortunately no line, so they were able to quickly procure their sandwiches on award-winning baguette.
"Shall we go eat these in the Palais Royal garden?" proposed Jean.
"If you don't mind, could we just sit on the Opera House steps?" requested Elodie anxiously. "I really want to get to the bottom of the curious documents I found as quickly as possible."
"Sure, no problem," he accepted reluctantly.
"Don't worry," said Elodie. She was keenly aware of his strong aversion to anything dusty and dirty, like outdoor steps.
"I have one of those free newspapers they give out on the subway in my bag. We can sit on its pages."
His furrowed brow relaxed, and they found a place on the Garnier steps, far enough away from the few others who'd had the same idea as Elodie. In between bites, Elodie spilled the beans on what she had discovered and explained the mystery she hoped to solve.
"Well, I do know there are a few official secret passages, like the narrow one that goes from the lake all the way up to the fourth floor," started Jean. "But I suppose it isn't out of the question that there are others."
"I scoured all the plans this morning and didn't find any clues," said Elodie, frustrated.
"If there's anyone who might have actually noticed something unusual or out of place, it's Michel," answered Jean.
"Michel?"
"Michel, the old custodian," he clarified. "He knows the building like the back of his hand. He's been working here forever."
"Okay, maybe not forever. He wasn't working here when the Opera House first opened, but he's been here for at least 40 years. I believe he's retiring soon."
"It wouldn't hurt to ask him," said Elodie.
"Okay, I'll help you find him, but then I really should get back to work," Jean said, looking at his watch.
He must be the only Frenchman who respected the actual time frame of an hour-long lunch break. After finishing up their sandwiches, they went on the hunt for Michel. They started by roaming the various foyers. Not one detail of the opulent interiors had been overlooked by Garnier and his troupe of gifted artists and artisans. Every surface was adorned with sculptures, paintings, crystal, mirrors, and gold. Everything was gold. Gold paint, gold gilding, and gold candelabras. Throughout the world, gold seemed to always denote wealth, power, and importance. The global effect of these glamorous rooms made you feel like you were at a miniature Versailles. Beautiful as these rooms were, there was no Michel. They checked the more intimate Rotonde du Glacier and Rotonde des Abonnés, round public vestibules located under the auditorium. No Michel. They even popped into the Salon Florence Gould, named in honor of the famous American philanthropist. Still no Michel. This left them with the maze of storage and rehearsal rooms found behind the scenes, which would be a nightmare to search through, or the building's largest room, the vast 2,000-seat auditorium. This is where they decided to continue their search. Jean heaved open the large door, and the pair were suddenly enveloped by warm golds and sensual reds, colors chosen to accentuate the beauty of the audience members. Overhead was Marc Chagall's whimsical ode to opera, featuring 14 scenes from the works of Mozart, Puccini, Bizet, Verdi, and other musical masterminds. Even though the building had so many references to opera, since opening, it has also been used for ballet. Today, most operatic performances took place at the Modern Opera House, located in Place de la Bastille and built in the 1980s to commemorate the bicentennial of the first French Revolution,
just like the pyramid of the Louvre. Misha! Elodie called out. Her words echoed through the cavernous room.
No use doing that, advised Jean. Despite this room's amazing acoustics, Michel's hard of hearing.
Poor guy. That means he can't even make the most of the place where he works.
Oh, sure he does, Jean insisted. Maybe not audibly, but visually. You can often find him sitting at the back of the auditorium during ballet rehearsals. Actually, there's one about to start, which is why there aren't any tours taking place in here right now.
Hey, what's that? Elodie asked upon hearing what sounded like loud snores amplified by the room's acoustics. The two followed the deep nasal noises towards the back of the auditorium. Sure enough, the snores guided them straight to a snoozing Michel, slouched down in one of the room's plush red velour seats. Jean cleared his throat loudly, but this had no effect on the dozing Michel. Jean and Elodie looked at each other. Jean was too polite. Elodie would have to take matters into her own hands. She shooed Jean out of Michelle's line of sight. From her pocket, she removed the crumpled receipt from her lunchtime sandwich. Standing behind Michelle, she leaned over and tickled his nose with the receipt, then jumped backwards. Well-mannered Jean put his hands over his eyes. How utterly embarrassing it would be if they got caught. Michel awoke with a start and quickly took the rag in his hand and began wiping down the wooden frame of the seat in front of him.
Oh, there you are, Michel, said Elodie, stepping forward as if she'd just arrived. Michel turned around, smiling pleasantly and polishing ferociously, as if he'd been at it for ages.
We need your help with an important matter.
What's that?
Michel asked. He stood up with some difficulty and clung to the chair he'd been sitting on.
How can I help?
We want to find a secret passageway. Elodie then gave him a brief rundown of the story. While she was providing the details, some dancers appeared on stage, out of costume and in casual practice leotards and tights. The rehearsal was about to begin.
If this Monsieur Blanc was that wealthy, he would have had one of the best private boxes, concluded Michel. There's the presidential box, originally built for the emperor. It wouldn't be that one, but there are several others that are almost as prestigious. If he commissioned Garnier to make him a secret passageway, it would likely be in one of those.
That makes sense, said Elodie. Any idea which one?
Yes,
he said, pointing across the room.
That deluxe box over there has a perfect view of the stage. Plus, it's next to the wall, so it would be ideal for a secret passageway.
Allons-y, let's go, she cheered.
Jean looked hesitant. He checked his watch again.
I should really be getting back to work, he said.
Come on, Jean, please, implored Elodie. It's the first day you're open to the public. There were barely any people at the library this morning, and if your colleagues really need you, they could always call you.
Bon décor. Okay, Jean agreed reluctantly.
No sooner were Elodie and Michel marching towards the door. Only 5 more minutes, he added as he trailed after them. Exiting the auditorium, they went up a set of stairs. Michel guided them to the left and stopped in front of the last of that level's private boxes. Elodie pointed up at the door, completely stupefied. F.B. She read out the initials painted on the door in faded gold. François Blanc.
That must be it, exclaimed Jean, pleased he'd tagged along after all.
Michel pulled a massive keyring from his pocket. It seemed to contain every type and size of key you could imagine. He selected an elegant old-fashioned brass one, the master key for the boxes. He slid it into the lock and gently pushed open the door. The trio tiptoed inside like shy young dancers.
"Places!"
shouted the choreographer, startling the three amateur sleuths. Elodie crept up to the edge of the box. It certainly had the perfect view of the stage. The dancers lined up, and the choreographer motioned to the rehearsal pianist to start. The music was from Mirante Silvia, which had actually premiered on that very stage in 1876. Although, considering the backdrop, which had just been installed, it looked like they would be doing a contemporary version of this classic ballet.
"I would imagine, if there is a secret passageway, it would be over on this side,"
Michel suggested, breaking Elodie's engrossed spell. "That makes sense," said Jean. The three of them proceeded to investigate the walls in search of any unusual crevices or openings.
"I don't see anything out of place," commented Jean.
Elodie ran her fingers up and down the trim. She stopped near the bottom. "Hey, what's this?" she asked. The spry and youngest of the group, Elodie agilely crouched down to inspect her possible find.
"It's a small keyhole. Michel, are there any very small keys on your key ring?"
"I think so,"
he said, rifling through his collection.
"Aha! I've always wondered what this one was for."
He held up a tiny key, no more than an inch long. Although it was tarnished from age, it didn't look like it had been used much.
"Let's give it a try," Elodie proposed.
Michel handed her his clunky set of keys, and she carefully inserted it into the lock. It fit. She slowly turned it to the left, and a section of the wood paneling creaked open. The trio gasped.
"We found it," whispered Elodie in awe.
"Maybe we should go tell the director about this," suggested Jean trepidatiously, always one to err on the side of caution.
"Let's just have a quick look first," Elodie insisted.
Michel unhooked a small flashlight from his belt and shone the light inside. Elodie peered over his shoulder. At first, the space looked more like a closet.
"What are those?" asked Michel.
On the ground to one side were scattered pieces of torn-up paper.
Elodie bent down to pick them up.
"They're old programs," she noted. "I wonder why they're ripped up."
"That's strange,"
said Jean, trying to read the text on the pages. Elodie skimmed through them quickly. "They all seem to feature the same lead dancer," noted Elodie, "a certain Cléo Deschamps."
"Cléo Deschamps?" gasped Jean.
"Do you know of her?" asked Michel.
"Oh, yes," he answered. "She's something of a mystery, as I'm sure you both know, or at least have seen in the paintings of Edgar Degas. There were various categories of ballerinas in the 1800s. At the bottom were les petits rats, the little rats, young dancers generally from poor families and often with somewhat flexible morals. Wealthy benefactors would often attend rehearsals and were doted on by some of the girls who were trying to secure the protection and financial assistance of these influential men. Of course, not all the dancers resorted to this dubious system.
The best ballerinas, who were striving to be chosen as lead dancers, were much more cautious. They often had a mother or an aunt who would also attend rehearsals to keep a watchful eye on their family's valuable assets. Cléo Duchamp fell into this latter category. With exceptional beauty and skill, she was quickly spotted and was soon on track to become la danseuse étoile, the star dancer of the Paris Opera. In fact, she was supposed to be the star of Mirante's Sylvia, but she suddenly disappeared, completely vanished. No one knows what happened to her.
It seems like Monsieur Blanc was particularly interested in Cléo, observed Elodie. I wonder if he was her benefactor.
Or maybe he was trying to woo her, hence the passageway, suggested Michel.
Jean and Elodie looked over at the custodian, surprised by his interest in the affair. He shone the light around in the secret alcove. His flashlight stopped on the ground.
Elodie, is that a little lever down there?
She set the programs down on one of the box's velour seats and got down on her hands and knees. She worked her fingers around the edge of the board Michel was referring to.
Aha! She proclaimed as her fingers slid under a recess. She pulled the boards, which easily came up in one grouping. A trap door!
Michel leaned over and shone his light down.
Stairs!
Indeed, his flashlight revealed a very narrow spiral staircase.
I wonder where they lead to. Elodie looked over at Michel and Jean.
With my bad hip, I won't be trying those stairs. But here, you two can go,
said Michel, handing Jean his flashlight.
I'll wait here. It looks pretty dusty,
observed clean freak Jean. Not only did he have an aversion to dirt and dust, he also rather disliked claustrophobic places. These phobias most likely resulted from the time his father took him down into the tunnels of his workplace, Le Metro, and they got a little lost and dirty. He thought they'd end up in the catacombs. His father didn't seem too bothered, but the incident had forever left its mark on poor Jean.
Come on, Jean, Elodie persisted. We'll go tell the director right afterwards, I promise.
Okay, fine,
he complied. His degree of curiosity outweighed his aversions.
Just holler if you need anything,
said Michel as he went over to sit by the edge of the box to watch the rehearsal. With a renewed spring in his step, he returned to what he had obviously intended to spend part of his afternoon doing. His passion for dance made Elodie wonder if Michel had been a dancer in his youth, a petit rat himself. Elodie turned towards the steps and carefully descended them one by one. Jean followed closely behind, shining the light on the stairs. They seemed to go down about the equivalent of 3 stories, then stopped on a small landing. Here there was another door. The word loge was written on it.
The dressing rooms, said Jean.
Just what I thought.
Benefactors were allowed to attend the rehearsals. However, visiting a prima donna in her dressing room was a very coveted privilege, and not an easy one to obtain.
Look, more torn up bits of paper, said Elodie, reaching down to pick them up. It seems like there are 2 types of paper. Here, I'll give you the beige pieces, and I'll try the light pink ones. Let's try to figure out what they are.
The two spent a few minutes attempting to assemble their puzzles of paper.
Mine is a check, concluded Jean. For 10,000 francs.
Wow, that's a lot of money, declared Elodie.
Don't forget, these would be ancien francs, clarified Jean. Old francs from the 1800s. Their monetary value was different from the francs used in France before the euro was rolled out in 2002.
That may be true, but it still sounds like a substantial sum, said Elodie.
Yes, I imagine that's equivalent to around 50,000 euros today, said Jean. Have you figured out your papers?
It seems to be a letter, said Elodie, holding the pieces together. Cher Monsieur Blanc, thank you for your complimentary letter, the bouquet of beautiful roses, and your over-generous gift. However, I am afraid I am unable to accept it. I'm in love with Gaston, and we are running away together tonight after the performance. We have pledged ourselves to each other. Do not try to find me. Adieu, Cléo. Wow, exclaimed Elodie when she had finished.
I guess that solves it, concluded Jean. Blanc had been pursuing her and even got Garnier involved to help him. Garnier was corruptible, but Cléo wasn't.
But the mystery still isn't completely solved, said Elodie. Where did Cléo and this Gaston go?
Jean turned the flashlight around the space.
Look, he said, the passageway continues.
Let's see where it goes, suggested Elodie.
The pair followed the passageway, which started as a straight corridor and then made a right-angled turn. At the end was a small door closed by a latch. Elodie flipped it up and the door came ajar.
They were in the Raton des Abonnés. Of course, from here one could discreetly slip in or out of the passageway. The vestibule was just beneath the grand staircase, so one could conveniently exit the building from here.
Cléo must have discovered the secret passageway, said Jean.
Yes, and she turned its intended purpose around in her favor, deduced Elodie. Instead of Blanc using it to court her, she used it to escape with Gaston.
Clever Cléo, stated Jean.
But who is this Gaston? Wondered Elodie out loud. Do you think he also worked here at the opera?
That's a good guess. Cléo would have rarely left the building with her intense schedule, said Jean.
Just then his face lit up, struck by an idea.
I know how we can find out.
Follow me.
Great, chimed Elodie. She scurried after Jean, who was already jogging up the grand staircase, back in the direction of the library.
As he pushed open the door, the other librarians raised an eyebrow, as if to say, "Where have you been?" But Jean didn't even make eye contact with them as he rushed in the direction of his desk. He quickly sat down in front of his computer, put in his password, and did some frantic typing.
What are you looking for? Asked Elodie.
We've recently digitized the staff records, dating all the way back to the opera house's opening in January 1875. I can do a keyword search by name. Voila!
There have been 3 Gastons on staff, and one stopped working here in the fall of 1875.
That's exactly when Cléo disappeared.
Jean clicked on the profile.
Gaston Ledoux.
What was his job?
He was in charge of raising and lowering the massive stage curtain. On the sidelines, he must have spent hours admiring the lovely Cléo from a similar vantage point as Monsieur Blanc.
Wow!
Wait a second, said Jean. Ledoux. That name sounds familiar.
Jean quickly plugged in a new search.
2 names have come up for Ledoux. Gaston Ledoux and Michel Ledoux, declared Jean.
Michel? Questioned Elodie.
Yes, our Michel, confirmed Jean.
Let's go find him, said the ecstatic Elodie. The pair zoomed back out of the library, passing the puzzled and disapproving other librarians. Michel was right where they'd left him, enraptured by the dancers, fingers drumming on the box's ledge, along with the music, like tiny footsteps of Les Petits Rats.
Michel! Called Elodie.
Startled from his trance, he sat up straight.
So, what did you find?
He asked. Before getting around to that, we have a question for you, said Jean. Do you know if you had a Gaston in your family, an ancestor?
Why, yes, he replied after a minute's reflection. My great-grandfather was called Gaston. My family used to run a ballet school out in Normandy, but my parents decided to move to Paris, continued Michel. I always had fond memories of watching those petits rats practicing at the school. I guess that's why I ended up applying for a job at the opera house.
Why didn't you try to become a dancer? Asked Elodie.
Look at me, he said, gesturing to his broad shoulders. Alas, I don't have the right physique.
Elodie and Jean smiled. Despite his sturdy size, dance nonetheless flowed through his veins. They knew he'd be thrilled to find out the true story about his great-grandparents, and at that moment they also knew exactly what the team should get Michel for his retirement present, a lifetime season's pass to the Opera Garnier.